And this is all work with John Imbrie. And there are two papers, and the first one was with John Imbrie and Steve Evans, and that was published in 1992, and the second one is work in progress that I'll refer to in a moment. So, brief description of the hierarchical lattice. To describe what it is, you need an integer L. And the picture that I'm drawing here is when L is cap is 2. Which won't be the case for the models that I want to talk about, but it's the easiest picture to draw. This is a picture of the topology on the lattice. That's a picture of the balls, and the only balls you have in this topology are balls of size diameter 2, then diameter 4, 8, and 16 and on upwards, powers of 2. None of these balls overlap, which is completely different from the topology on the simple cubic lattice, and that's what makes it so much easier to work with a hierarchical lattice, and I'll try to describe that later. For example, you take these two points, X and Y, there. Now, they look like they're very close together in this lattice, but they are not, because in order to find out the distance between them, you have to find the smallest ball that contains them both. And you see that that doesn't happen until you reach this scale up here, which is a ball of size L to the power of 4. So they're 16 units apart in this topology. The dimension of this lattice, the lattice, by the way, is just these points at the bottom. The dimension of the lattice is 1, because if you ask how many sites there are in a ball of, say, L to the 4, there are 16. It's growing, the number of sites in a ball is growing at the same rate as the diameter. And if you wanted a four-dimensional lattice, you'd have to have the number of sites growing as the diameter to the power of 4, which is actually what I'll be doing in the sequel here. I just can't draw those pictures so easily with my limited abilities with tech. Now, it's nice to know, and this is something that hierarchical lattices were certainly introduced way before us. They go back to Dyson, and even walks on hierarchical lattices have been discussed way before us. There were papers in 1988 that I know about, and there may have been ones earlier, but those are the earliest I know by Knapp and others. I think one thing we did which is nice is we introduced a group structure so that actually the distance between two points x and y is a norm of x minus y, just like a Euclidean norm. The group structure isn't the one that you're quite used to. What you have to do is this. Take these two points here and think of them as z2. And then take four points and think of them as z2 direct sum z2. So, for example, here I'm showing you that I've labeled them 0, 1, which is the two conventional ways to label the additive group z2. And then the direct sum of z2 with z2, you'd have 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. That's a way of labeling the direct sum of two of them. But the point is that if you think of it as the direct sum, you realize that when you want to add or subtract two points in this group structure, you never carry. You subtract each entry. Like, for example, here I've got x and y, and I'm subtracting x, y from x. I'm saying even if I'd had a 1, like here and here, there's a 1 and a 1, you don't do any carrying. 1 plus 1 is just 0 in the group z2. And it's then, if you use that minus, that negative, if you use x plus minus y is the inverse of y, you use that structure, that the metric that I just introduced of looking for the smallest ball that contains two points is the same as just looking at x minus y and asking for the smallest ball that contains x minus y in the origin. So it's a translation invariant metric in that group. That helps with computations a lot. There's also a natural scaling structure on this lattice. If you remember from the previous slide, G sub J is the jth ball, which means it's the direct sum of J copies of Z2. You can just map it into G sub J minus 1 by modding out a Z2. And geometrically, that just corresponds to taking in this one-dimensional lattice got these points, collapse those to a single one. And in terms of representing X as a sequence, you see, I've represented X as a non-ending sequence of zero ones. It goes as far as you like this way, because we're in an infinite lattice. And the most significant digit is on the left, if you see what I mean here. That's why I've drawn it that way. L minus 1 of X simply shifts these digits. So it's exactly like, it's very much like having a decimal expansion and dividing by 10 by just moving to the right. Right, now random walk on this lattice, where I want to define it, is like this: the probability that you make a jump from X to Y, so the probability that at time T plus DT you're at Y, given that you're at time X, is proportional to the distance, X minus Y, in this hierarchical lattice, to the power of minus D minus 2, where D is the dimension of the lattice. So, for example, for a four-dimensional hierarchical lattice, it'll be proportional to X minus Y to the power of minus 6. Now, that's big jumps. Now, this is very different from the walk on a simple cubic lattice where you only have nearest neighbor jumps. But you have to allow big jumps, because otherwise it will never get out of a given ball, because that's the structure, that if you only allow a jump up to a finite range, it'll always stay in the ball of that finite range. So this is a little unusual and takes a bit of getting used to, but the point of having that particular power is coming up in a moment. Define the beta potential. This is the Green's function, and beta is the killing rate. Just by taking expectation over all walks that start at A and are forced to end at B by this indicator function here. And they do it in time T, and you integrate over T. And so I'm going to be using this symbol G for this Green's function. The Green's function, you just think of it as 1 over 1 minus the as 1 over beta plus the generator. That's actually what it is. This process looks a little weird, but it's not so unusual in the sense that it still has the standard behavior of going square root of the... If you give it time t, it's gone a distance square root of t from the origin, typically, in the sense of expectation here. So it's like a... It behaves like a standard nearest neighbor random walk in that respect, and not only in that respect. Here are some properties of the Green's function. Look at the first property. If we take the killing rate to be zero, corresponding to leaving that out there and just looking at the inverse of the generator, then we find that it's exactly 1 over the distance b to the power of 2 minus d. This is exactly, usually, a simple, so on a simple cubic lattice, cd, nearest neighbor walk, Green's function, when beta is 0, and x, behaves like 1 over x to the power of d minus 2, for d, not 2, for d, and my d is always going to be 4. So it behaves like 1 over x squared in four dimensions. Well, this process is behaving in exactly the same way. It's the same law. It's actually exactly equal to that. That's why we chose this strange power law here. That gives you that. Just trying to create a model that resembles the simple random walk very strongly in terms of scaling behavior, and yet is a little easier to analyze. Now, another important property, the Green's function, is actually the sum of one function scaled, sum of scalings of one function. And I remind you that last time I was talking about the renormalization group and the important structure that underlay a lot of the analysis I did then was to look at Gaussian measures with covariance as C, where C is a function of x minus y with a property that it's the integral from, say, 0 to infinity, or sometimes I had other intervals, of scalings of one single function, which I call C dot. That encodes a scaling behavior into a Gaussian measures. The Gaussian measures I'm talking about haven't yet appeared. I'm just reminding you of something we did last time. Well, this Green's function is not an integral, but it's a sum over scalings, and that's enough to allow us to do very much the same types of things as I was doing last time. Scaling is defined at the bottom here. You move the points closer together by a factor of L, and you change the size of the function by some parameter, which in the case of four dimensions, this parameter phi that I'm talking about, which is the dimension of a field, is going to be 1. Now, another important property, which is one that will help a lot even in the real model, to the extent that we have plans or have plans for doing the real model on the simple cubic lattice, this is another a nice property to have, if you can get it, to have the Green's function that you want to study be a sum of scalings of a function with compact support. This, of course, is the hierarchical metric here, but that's very useful. Probably I'll only be able to explain why, though, in the next talk for the real model, but you'll see clearly why it plays a big role in this model. The other thing I just forgot to mention is that for what I have to do next, I have to reduce these systems to finite lattices, and the way that's done is just by killing the process as soon as it reaches the boundary. Dirichlet boundary conditions. Now, just to remind you about the tau isomorphism. So this is what I did in the first colloquium. The setup was that we get some, you have a look at a finite subset of an infinite lattice. Just label the points 1 to capital N. For each site in the infinite lattice, give yourself a complex variable. So there are n complex variables, phi 1 to phi n. Then you create a Gaussian measure written in a rather strange way, mu sub c. You can see e to the minus phi a phi conjugate, which is my shorthand for e to the minus sum over pairs of sites I and j of phi I a I j phi j conjugate. I'll tell you what A is in a moment. It'll be the same A which is the generator of the process. So this is phi A phi conjugate. And then there's this other thing, which is the differential form part. And by writing it in that, you're supposed to expand the exponential to understand what that means to get a normal differential form, which is the form you do the integral with respect to when you integrate over this mu sub c. Now, the covariance, as usual, is simply an integral over this Gaussian with a phi i, phi j, two random variables. And we connect this Gaussian measure up to our random walk problems by demanding that this covariance also be the Green's function for whatever process we're studying. It doesn't have to be hierarchical. This is very general. Any process on any finite state, on any finitely many states, you can do this with. And the conclusions I'm about to talk about are the same. We want to introduce interactions in some way, so this is something a little bit new, writing it this way. Just give yourself an arbitrary function of t, which vanishes at the origin, and it's smooth, and then any such function, actually I also require that it be bounded, I think I said that, good. Any such function you can uniquely write in terms of two parameters, beta and lambda, and an additional function r, the way I have it there. There's enough information. In other words, when you make a Taylor series expansion of this, you can exactly match the Taylor series of the function t. And that determines what the beta and lambda and the should be, and then the r is the remainder. So you can write any function that way. Maybe I do. Yes, I think I do. Thanks. I certainly do. First correction. So the r is order t cubed. That's normalizes the r to make it unique. And then, given yourself such a function, if tau sub I is the local time spent at a lattice site I by any whatever process we're looking at, in our case it'll be the hierarchical random walk, you can create a function of those local times by just taking g of tau for each lattice site and multiplying them all together. And just for a moment, let's just write out what that would look like. So I'm using this shorthand of g to the lambda just to mean product over sites in lambda of g evaluated at local time at the ith site. And if I write out that representation that I have up there, you can see that this is of this form. It's e to the minus beta sum tau I, and then e to the minus lambda sum tau I squared plus, I should write it this way first. E to the minus lambda tau I squared plus r tau I, and there's one of those factors for every site in the lattice. So if I were to neglect the r, or if for some reason the r was zero, then I would be studying this thing. Which is the Phi-4th type interaction which I was talking about in the first colloquium. Particularly if I remind you about the tau isomorphism. The tau isomorphism says that if you want to evaluate the expectation of one of these functions of local time, it's actually very general, it doesn't have to be of this form, any function of local time you can put there and there in this formalism here, but it happens to be this form in this case. So if you want to evaluate the expectation integrated over time, the t is the time for which the whole process exists, you can instead of doing a stochastic problem over here, you can do an almost Gaussian integral. There's the Gaussian, and there's g. And what does g of tau mean on this side? Tau isn't the local time anymore on the left-hand side, because local time doesn't make any sense under a Gaussian integral. Instead, tau is, roughly speaking, phi squared. But there's this differential form, d phi bar, added on. That was the tau. That's the content of the tau isomorphism. So then you can write out the tau isomorphism. It says that on one side, we have an expectation. And you see I've moved this e to the minus beta t. I'm taking advantage of the fact that this thing is the total time of the process. So it's not as random as it looks. Instead of being e to the minus beta sum of local times, it's e to the minus beta total time, which you can take outside the expectation, which I have here. And then you see that we have, in fact, a Laplace transform of the type of thing I'm trying to calculate. That's very important. So this is the Laplace transform of exactly the stochastic type of expression I want to calculate. And on the left-hand side here, we have a very high-dimensional integral to perform instead. The original problem is when r is zero. The e to the minus tau squared interaction is the self-avoiding or self-repelling interaction I've been talking about. But it's good to have that R there, because when I introduce the renormalization group in a moment, that will screw up that initial interaction in a certain way, and it'll lead to other more complicated forms. But those more complicated forms will always have this form. So that's why I put the R there. Right, now let's take a look at the renormalization group. So the renormalization group, when I was talking about it last time, had two pieces. It was an operator T sub T. There was a Gaussian convolution, which depended on T in some way, and there was a scaling by T acting after it. This was Mailer's formula. Now, in this case, T is in a certain sense 1. We have a discrete semigroup. Instead of T sub T, we have a discrete semigroup, corresponding to the fact that this lattice is invariant under discrete scalings. And so there's a single scaling, and there's a single Gaussian, and the scaling that we want is the one that moves all the points in the lattice closer together by a factor of L, and as before, changes the size of the field by an L to the minus 1. That's how scaling acts on fields. Now, once you know how it acts on fields, you know how it acts on d phi. Phi is a variable, d phi is a form, and you know how it acts on everything that I can build out of phi and d phi by change of variables, all functions of these things. The renormalization group is this discrete semigroup. Here's the same formula I have there. And the only thing is, what does convolution mean? Because mu sub gamma is a Gaussian, but it has forms, has d phis in it, and f has d phis in it too. And the way you convolve two forms together is not only do you have the usual zeta, zeta plus phi type combination, but you do the same thing with the forms, with the d zeta and d zeta plus phi. It's complete symmetry between the phis and the d phis in this way.
Pretty explicitly what that gamma is.
Remember that the covariance is written as a sum of scalings, a single function. And I know exactly what it is. Right, it's something very simple. Right, it's the difference of two characteristic functionals. It's the difference of a function which is one on a ball minus a multiple of a function which is one on a smaller ball. It's something very simple. I just didn't want to tell you what it was, even though it's quite pretty. One reason why I didn't want to tell you what it was, it's actually positive semi-definite rather than positive definite, so you have to do something about that, but that's okay. Now, here are the main properties of this renormalization group operation. The first one is really important because it's the one that shows you that it's a way of doing part of the integral. So I remind you that we want to do this integral. We want to do an integral of this form, and this g is actually a sum over scalings of a single function gamma, and what I'm signaling with this subscript lambda here is that When you kill the process, when you kill the random walk, when it reaches the boundary of some finite set, the covariance of the kill process, G, depends on the lambda, and instead of being an infinite sum, it's a finite sum up to something of order log lambda here, of scalings of that one function gamma. This is almost exact. It's actually true that the very last term is just slightly different from the other ones, but it is really a finite sum. And I'm signaling to you by the subscript lambda that the sum goes up to some top index, which is controlled by lambda. And then if you look on the other side of the first equation, the only difference is that all of a sudden I've inserted this renormalization group operation, but now I don't have to do such a big integral anymore. It's an integral which corresponds to a process which is killed on leaving a smaller lattice than the one I had before. So you can imagine we have very, very big lattice. And that means many, many degrees of freedom to integrate over in this integral here. But after one renormalization group operation, it's a lot smaller. So it's simplifying and decreasing the number of variables you have to integrate over to use this formula. Instead of doing a big integral over many variables, you can do a smaller integral, but then you have to first do a renormalization group transformation on the F. Now, another thing, and this is the critical simplifying feature of the hierarchical lattice right here, and that is that it's very easy to do the renormalization transformation because it has this property, it factors over balls of size L. You have a lattice in one dimension would look like that. And if I have a product, if the type of function I want to integrate is a product of functions at single sites, when you collapse the points down to get the newer, smaller lattice, you can do each renormalization group step separately, independently of all the others. And that's what I'm trying to signal with this formula there. That's just a precise way of saying that. Now here is another nice property, and that is that I plus G1 is just my way of saying taking the ball of size L around the site I. So these two points are Z2, and these two points here are 1 plus Z2. They're cosets, different cosets in this group here. And the important thing is that if these functions here began, as this one is, by being functions of tau, after you've done one step, they're still functions of tau on the new lattice. Now, to prove that, that's why I talked about supersymmetry in the first lecture. It's the fact that the renormalization group transformation commutes with the supersymmetry generator that gives you that fact. Otherwise, you'd have something more general. Another nice property, which is something very special to the hierarchical lattice, I mean, this kind of thing, I can imagine that type of thing surviving in a certain sense for the real problem, but this one here, if you have a phi, and remember we do, because I want to include these two points here, so long as they're in separate balls of size L, the effect of the renormalization group transformation in it is to change the G exactly the way it would have done even if the phi hadn't been there, and to just scale the phi and put it on the next site. It's very, very simple. That means that there's no wave function renormalization or no renormalization of observables in this model. So now we can see what the effect of the renormalization group is. T changes your lattice to a smaller one by a factor of L. It's one thing it does. It replaces the parameters beta, lambda, r, which I use to represent my G, by some new ones. Because, you see, what it does is it takes two of these Gs, as a G tau 1 and a G tau 2, and then you're doing the integral of G tau 1, G tau 2, you're convolving that with respect to this gamma, and you're rescaling, and you're getting a new function, G prime. It has to be some new function of tau. And these two points here, I'm sorry, this probably should be called tau 0 and tau 1, because this is point 0 and this is 1, have collapsed to 0. So this is G prime of tau 0 that you get there. This new function, you don't necessarily know what it is right away, but it still has that property that G of 0 is 1, not 0. It still has that property. And so it can still be represented in terms of new parameters, beta prime, lambda prime, and r prime. So we have a dynamical system that just maps you, as I've said here, from a beta lambda and r that define the g to a beta prime lambda prime r prime that define the new g. It's just a very simple dynamical system. Now, r isn't so simple because that's a function of forms, but still it's only one function, and then beta and lambda are two parameters. It's a very helpful feature. So with that, you can prove the following theorem. Now, a theorem in our first paper with Evans, we had a theorem on the Green's function where beta was zero. The big generalization here, and what's made this theorem a little bit more tricky, is that this is true for all beta, and it's true for all beta in a sector, and it's a very big sector too. You'll see why you need this in a moment. It's a sector that looks like this. And these two Green's functions, it's asserting that the Green's function with a repulsion, a self-repelling of strength lambda in it, is equal to the free Green's function. You just have to change the beta in some way to a new beta. And then there's an error. I mean, this equals, this thing minus this is less, I've written equals, but I'm trying to write something simple here. There's an error of order this thing in the difference between them. So it's not exactly equal, but there's something smaller, and because there's an extra factor of lambda in the something smaller, those terms actually don't contribute to the end-to-end distance.
You said in your 1992 work that you had that for beta equals zero, but do you really mean that you had it for beta equal to the critical value of the error, but not in the complex plane?
No, I'm sorry, you have it equal to the critical beta, right. Thanks, that's exactly right. This is the critical beta, so what we had in the first paper is just that point in this diagram. A similar statement for just that point. Here's the definition of the effective beta. It's a kind of scattering matrix. Yes, you drive the beta forward by the full renormalization group, and then you drive it back by the free renormalization group. These factors of L to the minus 2n are exactly how it would untransform by the free renormalization group if there was no interaction. Now, here's the idea of the proof. The properties of T that I had on the previous slide enable you to show that the interacting Green's function is equal to a new interacting Green's function. You apply the renormalization group transformation once, you see. So, this is what I'm doing. I have a phi A and a phi B, and these are not in the same ball. So, I know that this is the same thing as that. That's the property of the renormalization transformation. And then I know that this factors across different balls, so actually I can kind of divide it up into a part that acts on the part that's in one ball with this and the part that acts on the one ball with this, and then there are all these other balls and this factors and acts on those too. So after you've done that, you get new scaled lambda, and you get the new G prime to the power of the new scaled lambda, and you just get phi at L minus 1 of A and phi at L minus 1 of B, and you get a factor of L to the minus 1 in front of each. And that was the last statement that I had. That was the last property I had about the renormalization group, that it just acts on phis in that simple way. So what we can do is we can take two points, A and B, which are really far apart. We can apply the renormalization group over and over again, and they come in. And eventually, they meet in a single ball that contains the... eventually, they scale into one ball. Now, when you brought them together like this, there's no longer any interesting dependence on the B anymore. You've factored that all out. And then remember that the coupling constant lambda had its own evolution while you were doing this. The G was replaced by G prime and the lambda was replaced by lambda prime. So it evolved. And one of the things you have to do is to check that this lambda never gets large. In fact, it actually gets smaller under this action. So when you've gotten them all together here, you've actually got a very small lambda. And it's very easy then to show that it's almost equal to the free Green's function. So you replace it by the free Green's function. Then you back it all off back the way you came to get this formula. So that's what I mean by uniterating it, to get this formula that tells you that the interacting Green's function is equal to the free Green's function at another temperature. Now we come to, and have I left some time for this? Yes. We come to the part that's rather tough in this whole thing, which is undoing the Laplace transform. So remember that this integral, this Green's function, this is the interacting Green's function, let's take A to be zero, and then I can just write it as a single thing, is by the tau isomorphism, it's the integral from zero to infinity, dt, of e to the minus beta t of one of the things I'd like to calculate, which is the expectation of a walk going from zero, A is zero, I'll just write it as A, to B, of, then there's the interaction, e to the minus lambda sum tau x squared. And I would like to very much like to calculate that object there. And what I know how to calculate by what we've just done, we now know that this is equal to a free Green's function at a different beta. This one was this beta, and this one is this beta effective defined by this scattering matrix, scattering operation. Now, so what we have to do is to write this as the inverse Laplace transform of this. Which means, have I written it there? Yeah. Do an integral, as I've written up there, in the complex plane. It's a Watson integral. What's it? A Bromwich integral is what it's called, right? It's a Bromwich integral in the complex plane, e to the beta t of this Green's function. And I've immediately replaced this Green's function by the free Green's function at the effective beta, and I'm ignoring that error because it actually isn't important. This is the important part here. And then you can choose any contour you like. The interacting Green's function has a singularity. It's something called beta critical. You can prove that. And we don't really know what its structure is here. But remember, I have control over things in a sector. So I can put my contour anywhere to the right like that. And if I want, I can even bend it a bit. That seems to be the right thing to do. So then you have to calculate the recursion. So we have this recursion. Beta goes to beta prime. Lambda goes to lambda prime. R goes to R prime. And I didn't have time last time to explain second-order perturbation theory. That was the part where I suddenly said, so suddenly a shot rang out and everyone fell dead and we all left. But second order, if you'd seen that part, you would have seen now how you calculate the new beta and the new lambda, and not the new R, I wouldn't have done that for you, from the old lambda and the old beta. And there's a recursion relation that looks something like this for the beta. Where's that damn thing? The new beta is L squared times the old beta plus its 1 over 1 plus beta lambda squared with some constant in front. That's what it is, roughly. So the new effective beta is what you do when you divide that out. Actually, like that. And then there's also recursion for the lambda, which to second order, this is not the exact recursion, then there's an error. And then the new lambda is the old lambda minus a constant over 1 plus beta times lambda squared, and there's an error, an order lambda. These epsilons mean order lambda cubed errors. You calculate everything to order 2 in lambda. And then you have to prove that if you simply solve the recursions as well as you can with the second order parts, ignoring that, that gives you an accurate picture of what the full recursion does, which is true. And so if you just then look at this and deal with those explicit parts, you can prove that the effective beta is equal to the difference between the beta you started with from that critical beta with this, inside this log, times beta minus beta critical. In other words, there's a log correction. I may even have time to show you roughly why that is. But the there is this log correction. The beta effective, instead of just being linear in beta minus beta critical, has this log correction in it. Now that comes because of this term right here. That term, you see, if you only had, and I'm sorry, I think I've got this. This is right, but now what you have to do is you have to look for the fixed point of this formula, because the beta critical is the thing that where this side exactly. Wait. One second here. Yeah. Okay. The beta critical is defined in the following way. There's one unique value of beta, which if you iterate this recursion together with this and the one for the R, because they're all coupled together, the beta critical goes to zero. That's how it's defined. It's defined that way. So if I take away, if I look at the difference between this beta and the beta critical at each step, then I get this type of a formula and I get this log correction coming from this term here. I probably have to explain that in some detail to show you. But if you get that, once you've got that, once you've convinced yourself that that's true, then the end-to-end distance is affected by that log behavior as follows. Because we've taken the contour to slope backwards, and because the inverse Laplace transform has a factor of e to the beta t in it, you see that's exponentially decaying as you go, e to the beta t exponentially decays as you go down this thing. So the contribution to the integral only comes from a certain neighborhood, which is where this beta t is less than some constant of order 1. Then, which is what I'm writing here, then change, just look at that part of the integral, and you see this formula I have here, the logarithm has a beta minus beta c, but the log is rather slowly moving, and so you can replace the beta minus beta c by this... I'm sorry, this is not quite right. I should have a beta minus beta c here. That's wrong. Let me switch that, change that. Where is it? That should have been beta minus beta c. This order 1 upon t. So now I have to argue that beta minus beta c appearing in the logarithm can be replaced by 1 upon t because of this restriction to this range here. Then, new formula for beta effective is beta minus beta c with a log correction like that in it instead. And now we can change variable. So you see, what I'm really saying is that you should in fact change variables exactly from beta to beta effective in the Laplace transform. Now, that's a nonlinear change of variables. But if you make the change of variables in the neighborhood of beta critical, it's a linear change of variables by this formula with this log correction. So if you make that change of variables, going from the old beta to beta effective, then you can see out in front of the integral will come e to the beta ct. That's coming from that term in the change of variables. You've done this in the exponent. You will have e to the beta effective times t nu. T nu includes this log correction here. So t nu is t times this log correction. And then you have this free Green's function. Now, if you can get yourself to that stage, then everything is lovely, because this is exactly the inverse Laplace transform with the same beta there. That simply must reconstruct the expectation of the free interacting, of the free expectation, because that's just the inverse Laplace transform applied to the free Green's function. So it reconstructs the free expectation with this factor in front of one of all walks going from A to B. Now you have to divide by the normalization. You see, that's what makes this inverting of the Laplace transform rather tricky. To get the end-to-end distance, we have to look at the expectation of walks going from A to B of the interaction divided by, this isn't normalized anymore because of this factor, so you have to divide by the sum over all possible sites that the walk could end at of the same thing. But we have enough accuracy now to do that in this formula. This enormous exponential growing thing here, it's a huge factor there, cancels out top and bottom. And it leaves you with just the ratio of two free expectations. So from that, we immediately find, just because we're dealing with the free process, that the end-to-end distance is going to be the square root of t, but it's the t nu instead of the old t, which has this log correction in it. And I think I finally understood that these talks are only 50 minutes long and not 1 hour long, so I'm quitting here. They have exactly the same log to the 1/4 or log to the 1/8 correction, yes. Mm-hmm. Because that's entirely determined by the scaling and that recursion. It's determined by this thing. There's a thing here. I said it's c over 1 plus beta. And then there's beta equals L squared beta prime equals L squared beta plus 1 over 1 plus beta. I'm sorry, this is a square here. That one. 1 over 1 plus beta lambda squared. And the important thing is that when you differentiate this one with respect to beta, you get 4 times that one. And that's true in both models. And that's something which is, it doesn't know what lattice it's on in order to get that. If you can give me any lattice you like, so long as they have this same scaling. That multiple there actually wouldn't matter what lattice you were on, but these things here, and the fact that there are no numbers here, and no, that's four-dimensional. In fact, there are no length scales there. But it's very robust.
Right, the experts in this don't really want to come to that. You know about, for instance, Joe, you know all about Feynman
diagrams and things. I just thought that they would like to know about Feynman diagrams and Laplace expansions and things like that.